Salmonis laughed and struck at the weapon with his sword, causing the Fade's mouth to open wide in surprise. That wasn't how men were supposed to react. They were supposed to stumble at the burning flare of pain, cry out as they knew their life had ended.
"I've already had one of your flaming swords in me, you son of a goat!"
Talmanis screamed, attacking time and time again. Blacksmith strikes the blade. Such an inelegant form. It fit his mood perfectly. The murderer stumbled. Talmanis swept back in a smooth motion, bringing his sword to the side and slicing the thing's pale white arm free at the elbow. The limb twisted in the air, the Fade's blade dropping from spasming fingers. Talmanis spun for momentum and brought his sword across with two hands, severing the Fade's head from its neck. Dark blood sprayed free and the thing fell, its remaining hand clawing at the bloodied stump as it collapsed. Talmanis stood over it, his sword suddenly feeling too heavy to hold. It slipped from his fingers, clanging to the paving stones. He tipped and lost his balance, falling face first, but a hand caught him from behind.
"Light!" Milton exclaimed, looking at the body. "Another one!" "I found the secret to defeating them," Talmanis whispered. "You just have to be dead already."
He chuckled to himself, though Milton just looked at him, seeming baffled. Around them, dozens of Trollocs collapsed to the ground, writhing. They'd been linked to the Fade. The band gathered around Talmanis, some bearing wounds. A few were down for good. They were exhausted and worn down. This batch of Trollocs could have ended them. Milton retrieved Talmanis's sword and swabbed it clean, but Talmanis found he was having trouble standing, so he sheathed it and had a man fetch a Trolloc spear for him to lean on.
"Ho! The back of the street!" a distant voice called. "Whoever you are, thank you."
Talmanis limped forward, Filger and Mar scouting on ahead without needing orders. The street here was dark and cluttered with Trollocs that had fallen moments ago, so it was a moment before Talmanis could climb over the corpses and see who had called to him. Someone had built a barricade at the end of the street. People stood atop it, including one who held aloft a torch. She had hair in braids and wore a plain brown dress with a white apron. It was Aludra.
"Cawthon's soldiers," Aludra said, sounding unimpressed. "Your time, you certainly did take it in coming for me."
In one hand she held a stubby leather cylinder larger than a man's fist, with a short length of dark fuse attached. Talmanis knew they exploded after she lit and threw them. The band had used them before, hurling them from slings. They weren't as devastating as dragons, but still powerful.
"Aludra," Talmanis called. "You have the dragons? Please tell me you saved them."
She sniffed, waving for some people to pull apart a side of the barricade to admit his men. She appeared to have several hundred, maybe several thousand, townspeople back there, filling the street. As they opened the way for him, he saw a beautiful sight. Surrounded by townspeople, 100 dragons rested there. The bronze tubes had been fitted to wooden dragon carts to comprise a single unit, pulled by 2 horses. They were really quite maneuverable, all things considered. Those carts could be anchored in the ground to manage recoil, Talmanis knew, and the dragons fired once the horses were detached. There were more than enough people here to do the work horses should have been available to do.
"You think I would leave them?" Aludra asked. "This lot. They do not have the training to fire them, but they can pull a cart as well as anyone else."
"We have to get them out," Talmanis said.
"This, it is a new revelation to you?" Aludra asked. "As if I haven't been trying to do that very thing. Your face, what is wrong with it?"
"I once ate a rather sharp cheese, and it has never quite sat right with me."
Aludra cocked a head at him. Maybe if I smiled more when I made jokes, he thought idly, leaning against the side of the barricade. Then they'd understand what I meant. That, of course, raised the question, did he want people to understand? It was often more amusing the other way. Besides, smiling was so garish.
Where was the subtlety? And he was really having trouble focusing. He blinked at Aludra, whose face had grown concerned in the torchlight.
What about my face?
Tamonis raised a hand to his cheek. Blood. The Murdral. Right.
Just a cut.
And the veins?
Veins? He asked, then noticed his hand. Tendrils of blackness, like ivy growing beneath the skin, had wound down his wrist and across the back of his hand toward the fingers. They seemed to be growing darker as he watched.
Oh, that. I'm dying, unfortunately. Terribly tragic.
You wouldn't happen to have any brandy, would you?
Aye. My lord!
A voice called. Tamonis blinked, then forced himself to turn about, leaning on the spear.
Yes, Filger. Mortalics, my lord. Lots of them. They're filling in behind us.
Lovely. Set the table. I hope we have enough dinnerware. I knew we should have sent the maid for that 5,731st set. Are you feeling all right?
Aludra asked.
Blood and bloody ashes, woman. Do I look like I'm feeling well? Gaibon, retreat is cut off. How far from the East Gates are we?
East Gates?
Gaibon called.
Maybe a half-hour march. We need to head further down the hill.
Onward we go, then, Tamonis said.
Take the scouts and go on point. Denil, make sure those local folk are organized to haul those dragons. Be ready to set up the weapons.
Tamonis,
Aludra said, stepping in.
Dragon's eggs and powder. We have few of them left. We will need the supplies from Berlon. Today, if you set up the dragons, a few shots for each dragon. This is all I can give you.
Denil nodded.
Dragons aren't meant to make up frontline units all by themselves, my lord. They need support to keep the enemy from coming too close and destroying the weapons. We can man those dragons, but we won't last long without infantry.
That's why we're running, Tamonis said. He turned, took a step, and was so woozy he almost fell.
And I believe I'll need a horse.
Mogadin stepped onto a platform of stone, floating in the middle of an open sea. Glassy and blue, the water rippled in the occasional breeze, but there were no waves. Neither was there land in sight. Moradin stood at the side of the platform, hands clasped behind his back. In front of him, the sea burned. The fire gave off no smoke, but it was hot, and the water near it hissed and boiled. Stone flooring in the middle of an endless sea. Water that burned. Moradin always had enjoyed creating impossibilities within his dream shards. Sit, Moradin said to her, not turning. She obeyed, choosing one of the four chairs suddenly arranged near the center of the platform. The sky was deep blue, cloudless, and the sun hung at about three-quarters of the way to its zenith. How long had it been since she'd seen the sun in Tel Arunriod? Lately, that omnipresent black storm had blanketed the sky. But then this wasn't completely Tel Arunriod. Nor was it Moradin's dream, but a melding of the two. Like a temporary lean-to built off the side of the dream world. A bubble of merged realities. Mogadin wore a gown of black and gold, lacework on the sleeves faintly reminiscent of a spider's web. Only faintly. One did well not to overuse a theme. As she sat, Mogadin tried to exude control and self-confidence. Once both had come easily for her. Today, trying to capture either was like trying to snatch dandelion seeds from the air, only to have them dance away from her hand. Mogadin gritted her teeth, angry at herself. She was one of the chosen. She had made kings weep, armies tremble, Her name had been used by generations of mothers to frighten their children, and now? She felt at her neck, found the pendant hanging there. It was still safe. She knew it was, but touching it brought her calmness.
"Do not grow too comfortable wearing that," Moradin said.
A wind blew across him, rippling the pristine ocean surface. On that wind she heard faint screams.
"You are not completely forgiven, Mugadin. This is a probation. Perhaps when you fail next, I will give the mind trap to Demondred."
She sniffed. He would toss it aside in boredom. Demondred wants only one thing. Althor. Anyone who does not lead him toward his goal is unimportant to him.
"You underestimate him," Moradin said softly. "The Great Lord is pleased with Demondred. Very pleased. You, however..."
Mugadin sank down in her chair, feeling her tortures anew. Pain, such as few in this world had ever known. Pain beyond what a body should be able to endure. She held to the Cour Suvra and embraced Sidar. That brought some relief. Before, channeling in the same room as the Cour Suvra had been agonizing. Now that she, rather than Moradin, wore the pendant, it was not so.
"Not just a pendant," she thought, clutching it. "My soul itself."
Darkness within. She had never thought that she, of all people, would find herself subject to one of these.
Was she not the spider? Careful in all that she did.
She reached her other hand up, clasping it over the one that held the pendant. What if it fell? What if someone took it? She wouldn't lose it. She couldn't lose it.
"This is what I have become."
She felt sick.
"I have to recover. Somehow."
She forced herself to let go of the mind trap. The last battle was upon them. Already Trollocs poured into the southern lands. It was a new war of the shadow, but only she and the other chosen knew the deeper secrets of the one power. The ones she hadn't been forced to give up to those horrible women. No. Don't think about that. The pain, the suffering, the failure. In this war they faced no 100 companions. No Aes Sedai with centuries of skill and practice. She would prove herself and past errors would be forgotten. Moradin continued to stare at those impossible flames. The only sounds were that of the fire and of the water that boiled near it. He would eventually explain his purpose in summoning her, wouldn't he? He had been acting increasingly strange lately. Perhaps his madness was returning. Once, the man named Moradin, or Ishamael, or Ilan Morin Tedronai, would have delighted in holding a Cour Suvra for one of his rivals. He would have invented punishments, thrilled in her agony. There had been some of that at the start. Then, he had lost interest. He spent more and more time alone, staring into flames, brooding. The punishments he had administered to her and Sindane had seemed almost routine. She found him more dangerous this way. A gateway split the air just to the side of the platform.
"Do we really need to do this every other day, Moradin?" Demondred asked, stepping through and into the world of dreams.
Handsome and tall, he had jet hair and a prominent nose. He gave Mugadin a glance, noting the mind trap on her neck before continuing.
"I have important things to do, and you interrupt them. There are people you need to meet, Demondred," Moradin said softly. "Unless the Great Lord has named you nameless without informing me, you will do as you are told.
Your playthings can wait. Demondred's expression darkened, but he did not object further. He let the gateway close, then turned to the side, looking down into the sea. He frowned. What was in the waters? She hadn't looked. She felt foolish for not having done so. What had happened to her caution? Demondred walked to one of the chairs near her, but did not sit. He stood, contemplating Moradin from behind. What had Demondred been doing? During her period bound to the mind trap, she had done Moradin's bidding, but had never found an answer to Demondred. She shivered again, thinking of those months under his control. Contemplating Moradin from behind. What had Demondred been doing? During her period bound to the mind trap, she had done Moradin's bidding, but had never found an answer to Demondred. She shivered again, thinking of those months under his control. I will have vengeance.
You've let Mogadin free, Demondred said. What of this Sindane? She is not your concern, Moradin said.
Mogadin had not failed to notice that Moradin still wore Sindane's mind trap. Sindane. It meant last chance in the old tongue, but the woman's true nature was one secret that Mogadin had discovered. Moradin himself had rescued Lanfear from Sindal, freeing her from the creatures that feasted upon her ability to channel. In order to rescue her, and of course to punish her, Moradin had slain her. That had allowed the great lord to recapture her soul and place it in a new body. Brutal, but very effective. Precisely the kind of solution the great lord preferred. Moradin was focused on his flames and Demondred on him, so Mogadin used the chance to slip out of her seat and walk to the edge of the floating stone platform. The water below was completely clear. Through it she could see the people very distinctly. They floated with their legs chained to something deep below, arms bound behind them. They swayed like kelp. There were thousands of them. Each of them looked up at the sky with wide, horrified eyes. They were locked in a perpetual state of drowning. Not dead, not allowed to die, but constantly gasping for air and finding only water. As she watched, something dark reached up from below and pulled one of them down into the depths. Blood rose like a blooming flower. It caused the others to struggle all the more urgently. Mogadin smiled. It did her good to see someone other than herself suffering. These might simply be figments, but it was possible that they were ones who had failed the great lord. Another gateway opened at the side of the platform, and an unfamiliar woman stepped through. The creature had alarmingly unpleasant features, with a hooked yet bulbous nose and pale eyes that were off-center with one another. She wore a dress that tried to be fine, of yellow silk, but it only served to highlight the woman's ugliness. Mogadin sneered and returned to her seat. Why was Moradin admitting a stranger to one of their meetings? This woman could channel. She must be one of those useless women who called themselves Aes Sedai in this age. Granted, Mogadin thought, sitting. She is powerful. How had Mogadin missed noticing one with this talent among the Aes Sedai? Her sources had picked out that wretched light-skirt Nynaeve almost immediately, yet they'd missed this hag?
This is who you wish us to meet, Demondred said, lips turning down. No, Moradin said absently. You've met Hesalam before.
Hesalam. It meant without forgiveness in the old tongue. The woman met Mogadin's eyes proudly, and there was something familiar about her stance. I have things to be about, Moradin, the newcomer said. This had better be...
Mogadine gasped. The tone in that voice.
Do not take that tone with me, Moradin cut in, speaking softly, not turning. Do not take it with any of us. Currently, even Mogadine is favored more than you.
Grendel?
Mogadine asked, horrified.
Do not use that name,
Moradin said, spinning on her, the burning water flaring up.
It has been stripped from her.
Grendel, Hesalam, sat down without looking again at Mogadine. Yes, the way the woman carried herself was right. It was her. Mogadine almost chortled with glee. Grendel had always used her looks as a bludgeon. Well, now they were a bludgeon of a different type. How perfect! The woman must be positively writhing inside. What had she done to earn such a punishment? Grendel's stature, her authority, the myths told about her, were all linked to her beauty. What now? Would she have to start searching for the most horrid people alive to keep as pets, the only ones who could compete with her ugliness? This time Mogadine did laugh. A quiet laugh, but Grendel heard. The woman shot her a glare that could have set a section of the ocean aflame all on its own. Mogadine returned a calm gaze, feeling more confident now. She resisted the urge to stroke the Cour Souvre. Bring what you will, Grendel, she thought. We are on level footing now. We shall see who ends this race ahead. A stronger wind blew past, and ripples started to rise around them, though the platform itself remained secure. Moradin let his fire die out, and nearby, waves rose. Mogadine could make out bodies, little more than dark shadows inside those waves. Some were dead. Others struggled for the surface, their chains removed, but as they neared the open air, something always towed them back down again.
We are few now, Moradin said. We four, and the one who is punished most, are all that remain. By definition, that makes us the strongest.
Some of us are, Mogadine thought. One of us was slain by Althor, Moradin, and required the Great Lord's hand to return him. Why had Moradin never been punished for his failure? Well, it was best not to look too long for fairness in the Great Lord's hand.
Still, we are too few.
Moradin waved a hand, and a stone doorway appeared on the side of the platform. Not a gateway, just a door. This was Moradin's dream shard. He could control it. The door opened, and a man strode through it and out onto the platform. Dark-haired, the man had the features of a Saldaean, a nose that was faintly hooked, eyes that tilted. He was handsome and tall, and Mogadine recognized him. The leader of those fledgling male Aes Sedai? I know this man. Masri...
That name has been discarded, Moradin said. Just as each of us upon being chosen discarded what we were and the names men called us. From this moment on, this man shall be known only as Mihail, one of the chosen.
Chosen? Hesalam seemed to choke on the word. This child? She cut off.
It was not their place to debate if one was chosen. They could argue among themselves, even plot, if they did so with care. But questioning the Great Lord, that was not allowed. Ever. Hesalam said no more. Moradin would not dare call this man chosen if the Great Lord had not decided it. There was no argument to be made.
Still, Mogadine shivered.
Taim, Mihail, was said to be strong, perhaps as strong as the rest of them.
but elevating one from this age with all of their ignorance, it galled her to consider that this Mihail would be regarded as her equal.
"I see the challenge in your eyes," Moradin said, looking at the three of them, "though only one of you was foolish enough to start voicing it. Mihail has earned his reward. Too many of our number threw themselves into contests with Al-Thor when he was presumed to be weak. Mihail instead earned Luz Theron's trust, then took charge of the training of his weapons. He has been raising a new generation of dreadlords to the Shadow's cause. What did the three of you have to show for your work since being released?"
"You will know the fruits I have harvested, Moradin," Demondred said, voice low. "You will know them in bushels and droves. Just remember my requirement. I face Al-Thor on the field of battle. His blood is mine, and no one else's."
He turned to meet their eyes, each in turn, then finally those of Mihail. There seemed to be a familiarity to them. The two had met before. "You will have competition with that one, Demondred," Mugadin thought. "He wants Al-Thor nearly as much as you do." Demondred had been changing lately. Once, he wouldn't have cared who killed Luz Theron, so long as the man died. What made Demondred insist on doing the deed himself?
"Mogadin," Moradin said, "Demondred has plans for the war to come. You are to assist him."
"Assist him?" she said.
"Do you forget yourself so quickly, Mogadin?"
Moradin's voice was silky.
"You will do as you are told. Demondred wants you watching over one of the armies that now lacks proper monitoring. Speak a single word of complaint, and you will realize that the pain you have known up to now is but a shadow of true agony."
Her hand went to the Corsouvre at her neck. Looking into his eyes, she felt her authority evaporate. "I hate you," she thought. "I hate you more for doing this to me in front of the others."
"The last days are upon us," Moradin said, turning his back on them. "In these hours you will earn your final rewards. If you have grudges, put them behind you. If you have plots, bring them to completion. Make your final plays, for this is the end."
Tomonas lay on his back, staring up at a dark sky. The clouds above seemed to be reflecting light from below, the light of a dying city. That was wrong. Light came from above, didn't it? He'd fallen from the horse not long after starting for the city gate. He could remember that, most of the time. Pain made it hard to think. People yelled at one another. I should have taunted Matt more, he thought, a hint of a smile cracking his lips. Stupid time to be thinking of such things. I have to find the dragons. Or did we find them already?
I'm telling you, the bloody things don't work like that.
Denil's voice.
They're not bloody Aes Sedai on wheels. We can't make a wall of fire. We can send these balls of metal hurtling through the Trollocs.
They explode,
Gaibon's voice.
We could use the extras like I say.
Tomanus' eyes drifted closed.
The balls explode, yes, Denil said. But we have to launch them first. Setting them all in a row and letting the Trollocs run over them won't do much.
A hand shook Talmanis' shoulder. Lord Talmanis, Melton said, there is no dishonor in letting it end now. I know the pain is great. May the last embrace of the mother shelter you. A sword being drawn, Talmanis steeled himself. Then he found that he really, really didn't want to die. He forced his eyes open and held up a hand to Melton, who stood over him. Jessamine hovered nearby with arms folded, looking worried.
"Help me to my feet,"
Talmanis said. Melton hesitated, then did so.
"You shouldn't be standing," Jessamine said.
"Better than being beheaded in honor,"
Talmanis grumbled, gritting his teeth against the pain.
Light, was that his hand? It was so dark. It looked as if it had been charred in a fire. What is going on?
"We're cornered, my lord,"
Melton said grimly, eyes solemn. He thought them all as good as dead.
"Denil and Gaibon are arguing over placement of the dragons for a last stand. Aludra is measuring the charges."
Talmanis, finally standing, sagged against Melton. Before him, 2,000 people clustered in the center of a large city square. They huddled like men in the wilderness, seeking one another's warmth on a cold night. Denil and Gaibon had set up the dragons in a half-circle, bowed outward, pointing toward the center of the city, refugees behind. The band was now committed to manning the dragons. 3 pairs of hands were needed to operate each weapon. Almost all of the band had had at least some training. The buildings nearby had caught fire, but the light was doing strange things. Why didn't it reach the streets? Those were all too dark. As if they'd been painted. Like... He blinked, clearing the tears of pain from his eyes, realization dawning. Trollocs filled the streets like ink flowing toward the half-circle of dragons that were pointed at them. Something held the Trollocs back for the moment.
"They're waiting until they are all together for a rush," Talmanis thought.
Calls and snarls came from behind. Talmanis turned, then clutched Melton's arm as the world lurched. He waited for it to steady. The pain was actually dulling, like glowing flames running out of fresh coal. It had feasted upon him, but there wasn't much left of him for it to eat. As things steadied, Talmanis saw what was creating the snarls. The square they were in adjoined the city wall, but the townspeople and soldiers had kept their distance from the wall, for it was coated with Trollocs like a thick grime. They raised weapons in the air and roared down at the people.
"They throw down spears at anyone who comes too close," Melton said. "We'd been hoping to reach the wall, then follow it along to the gate, but we can't. Not with those things up there raining death upon us. All other routes are cut off."
Aludra approached Gaibon and Denil.
"Charges I can set under the dragons," she said to them, softly, but not as softly as she should have. "These charges, they will destroy the weapons. They may hurt the people in an unpleasant way."
"Do it," Gaibon said very softly. "What the Trollocs would do is worse, and we cannot allow the dragons to fall into the Shadow's hands. That's why they're waiting. Their leaders are hoping that a sudden rush will give them time to overwhelm us and seize the weapons."
"They're moving,"
a soldier called from beside the dragons.
"Light, they're coming!"
That dark slime of Shadowspawn bubbled down the streets. Teeth, nails, claws, 2 human eyes. The Trollocs came from all sides, eager for the kill. Talmanis struggled to draw breath. On the walls, the calls grew excited.
"We're surrounded," Talmanis thought. "Pressed back against the wall, caught in a net, we..." Pressed back against the wall.
"Denil!"
Talmanis shouted over the din. The captain of the dragons turned from his line, where men waited with burning punks for the call to launch the one volley they'd have. Talmanis took a deep breath that made his lungs burn.
"You told me that you could level an enemy bulwark in only a few shots." "Of course,"
Denil called.
"But we're not trying to enter."
He trailed off.
"Light," Talmanis thought. "We're all so exhausted, we should have seen this."
"You, in the middle, Raiden's dragon squad. About face,"
Talmanis screamed.
"The rest of you, stay in position and fire at the oncoming Trollocs. Move, move, move!"
The dragoners sprang into motion, Raiden and his men hastily turning their weapons about, wheels creaking. The other dragons began to fire a pattern of shot that sprayed across the entire square. The booms were deafening, causing refugees to scream and cover their ears. It sounded like the end of the world. Hundreds, thousands of Trollocs went down in pools of blood as dragons' eggs exploded in their midst. The square filled with white smoke that poured from the mouths of the dragons. The refugees behind, already terrified by what they had just witnessed, shrieked as Raiden's dragons turned on them, and most of them fell to the ground in fright, clearing a path. A path that exposed the Trolloc-infested city wall. Raiden's line of dragons bowed inward like a cup, the reverse formation of those firing into the Trollocs behind, so that the tubes were pointed at the same section of city wall.
"Give me one of those bloody punks!"
Tulmanis shouted, holding out a hand. One of the Dragoners obeyed, passing him a flaming brand with a glowing red tip. He pushed away from Melton, determined to stand on his own for the moment. Gaibon stepped up. The man's voice sounded soft to Tulmanis's strained ears.
"Those walls have stood for hundreds of years. My poor city. My poor, poor city."
"It's not your city any longer," Tulmanis said, raising his flaming brand high in the air, defiant before a wall thick with Trollocs, a burning city to his back. "It's theirs."
Tulmanis swiped the brand down in the air, leaving a trail of red. His signal ignited a roar of dragon fire that echoed throughout the square. Trollocs, pieces of them at least, blew into the air. The wall under them exploded like a stack of children's blocks kicked at a full run. As Tulmanis wavered, his vision blackening, he saw the wall crumble outward around the hole. When he toppled, slipping into unconsciousness, the ground seemed to tremble from the force of his fall. Chapter 1. Eastward the wind blew. The wheel of time turns and ages come and pass, leaving memories that become legend. Legend fades to myth, and even myth is long forgotten when the age that gave it birth comes again. In one age, called the Third Age by some, an age yet to come, an age long past, a wind rose in the mountains of mist. The wind was not the beginning. There are neither beginnings nor endings to the turning of the wheel of time. But it was a beginning. Eastward the wind blew, descending from lofty mountains and coursing over desolate hills. It passed into the place known as the Westwood, an area that had once flourished with pine and leatherleaf. Here the wind found little more than tangled underbrush, thick save around an occasional towering oak. Those looked stricken by disease, bark peeling free, branches drooping. Elsewhere needles had fallen from pines, draping the ground in a brown blanket. None of the skeletal branches of the Westwood put forth buds. North and eastward the wind blew, across underbrush that crunched and cracked as it shook. It was night, and scrawny foxes picked over the rotting ground, searching in vain for prey or carrion. No spring birds had come to call, and most telling, the howls of wolves had gone silent across the land. The wind blew out of the forest and across Tarren Ferry. What was left of it? The town had been a fine one, by local standards. Dark buildings, tall above their redstone foundations, a cobbled street built at the mouth of the land known as the Two Rivers. The smoke had long since stopped rising from burned buildings, but there was little left of the town to rebuild. Feral dogs hunted through the rubble for meat. They looked up as the wind passed, their eyes hungry. The wind crossed the river eastward. Here clusters of refugees carrying torches walked the long road from Berlon to Whitebridge despite the late hour. They were sorry groups, with heads bowed, shoulders huddled. Some bore the coppery skin of Domani, their worn clothing displaying the hardships of crossing the mountains with little in the way of supplies. Others came from farther off. Terrabonners with haunted eyes above dirty veils, farmers and their wives from northern Gildon. All had heard rumors that in Andor there was food. In Andor there was hope. So far, they had yet to find either. Eastward, the wind blew along the river that wove between farms without crops, grasslands without grass, orchards without fruit. Abandoned villages, trees like bones with the flesh picked free. Ravens often clustered in their branches. Starveling rabbits and sometimes larger game picked through the dead grass underneath. Above it all, the omnipresent clouds pressed down upon the land. Sometimes that cloud cover made it impossible to tell if it was day or night. As the wind approached the grand city of Camelon, it turned northward, away from the burning city, orange, red, and violent, spewing black smoke toward the hungry clouds above. War had come to Andor in the still of night. The approaching refugees would soon discover that they'd been marching toward danger. It was not surprising. Danger was in all directions. The only way to avoid walking toward it would be to stand still. As the wind blew northward, it passed people sitting beside roads, alone or in small groups, staring with the eyes of the hopeless. Some lay as they hungered, looking up at those rumbling, boiling clouds. Other people trudged onward, though toward what they knew not. The last battle to the north, whatever that meant. The last battle was not hope. The last battle was death. But it was a place to be, a place to go. In the evening dimness, the wind reached a large gathering far to the north of Camelon. This wide field broke the forest-patched landscape, but it was overgrown with tents like fungi on a decaying log. Tens of thousands of soldiers waited beside campfires that were quickly denuding the area of timber. The wind blew among them, whipping the smoke from fires into the faces of soldiers. The people here didn't display the same sense of hopelessness as the refugees, but there was a dread to them. They could see the sickened land. They could feel the clouds above. They knew. The world was dying. The soldiers stared at the flames, watching the wood be consumed. Ember by ember, what had once been alive, turned to dust. A company of men inspected armor that had begun to rust despite being well-oiled. A group of white-robed Aiel collected water, former warriors who refused to take up weapons again, despite their toe having been served. A cluster of frightened servants, sure that tomorrow would bring war between the White Tower and the Dragon Reborn, organized stores inside tents shaken by the wind. Men and women whispered the truth into the night. The end has come. The end has come. All will fall. The end has come. Laughter broke the air. Warm light spilled from a large tent at the center of the camp, bursting around the tent flap and from beneath the sides. Inside that tent, Randall Thor, the dragon reborn, laughed, head thrown back.
"So what did she do?"
Rand asked when his laughter subsided. He poured himself a cup of red wine, then one for Perrin, who blushed at the question. "He's become harder," Rand thought. But somehow he hasn't lost that innocence of his. Not completely. To Rand, that seemed a marvelous thing. A wonder, like a pearl discovered in a trout. Perrin was strong, but his strength hadn't broken him.
"Well," Perrin said, "you know how Marin is. She somehow manages to look at even Sen as if he were a child in need of mothering. Finding Fael and me lying there on the floor like two fool youths. Well, I think she was torn between laughing at us and sending us into the kitchen to scrub dishes. Separately, to keep us out of trouble."
Rand smiled, trying to picture it. Perrin. Burly, solid Perrin. So weak he could barely walk. It was an incongruous image. Rand wanted to assume his friend was exaggerating, but Perrin didn't have a dishonest hair on his head. Strange how much about a man could change while his core remained exactly the same.
Anyway, Perrin said after taking a drink of wine, Fahil picked me up off the floor and set me on my horse, and the two of us pranced about looking important. I didn't do much. The fighting was accomplished by the others. I'd have had trouble lifting a cup to my lips.
He stopped, his golden eyes growing distant.
You should be proud of him, Rand. Without Dennel, your father and Matt's father, without all of them, I wouldn't have managed half what I did. No, not a tenth.
I believe it. Rand regarded his wine. Luce Theron had loved wine. A part of Rand, that distant part, the memories of a man he had been, was displeased by the vintage. Few wines in the current world could match the favored vintages of the Age of Legends. Not the ones he had sampled, at least. He took a small drink, then set the wine aside. Min still slumbered in another part of the tent, sectioned off with a curtain. Events in Rand's dreams had awakened him. He had been glad for Perrin's arrival to take his mind off what he had seen.
Mieren. No. He would not let that woman distract him. That was probably the point of what he had seen.
Walk with me, Rand said. I need to check on some things for tomorrow. They went out into the night. Several maidens fell into step behind them as Rand walked towards Seven Balwer, whose services Perrin had loaned to Rand. Which was fine with Balwer, who was prone to gravitate toward those holding the greatest power.
Rand? Perrin asked, walking beside him with a hand on Mahalainir. I've told you about all of this before. The siege of the Two Rivers, the fighting. Why ask after it again?
I asked about the events before, Perrin. I asked after what happened. But I did not ask after the people it happened to. He looked at Perrin, making a globe of light for them to see by as they walked in the night.
I need to remember the people. Not doing so is a mistake I have made too often in the past.
The stirring wind carried the scent of campfires from Perrin's nearby camp, and the sounds of smiths working on weapons. Rand had heard the stories. Power wrought weapons discovered again. Perrin's men were working overtime, running his two Ashaman ragged to make as many as possible. Rand had lent them as many more Ashaman as he could spare, if only because, as soon as they'd heard, he had dozens of maidens presenting themselves and demanding power-wrought spearheads. It only makes sense, Randall Thor, Beralna had explained. His smiths can make 4 spearheads for every sword. She grimaced, saying the word sword, as if it tasted like seawater. Rand had never tasted seawater. Luce Theron had. Knowing facts like that had greatly discomforted him once. Now he had learned to accept that part of him.
Can you believe what has happened to us? Perrin asked. Light. Sometimes I wonder when the man who owns all these fancy clothes is going to walk in on me and start yelling, then send me out to muck the stables for being too big-headed for my collar.
The wheel weaves as the wheel wills, Perrin. We've become what we needed to become. Perrin nodded as they walked on the path between tents, lit by the glow of the light above Rand's hand.
How does it feel? Perrin asked. Those memories you've gained. Have you ever had a dream that, upon waking, you remembered in stark clarity? Not one that faded quickly, but one that stayed with you through the day?
Yes, Perrin said, sounding oddly reserved.
Yes, I can say that I have.
It's like that, Rand said. I can remember being Luce Theron, can remember doing what he did, as one remembers actions in a dream. It was me doing them, but I don't necessarily like them, or think I'd take those actions if I were in my waking mind. That doesn't change the fact that, in the dream, they seemed like the right actions. Perrin nodded.
He's me, Rand said, and I'm him. But at the same time, I'm not. Well, you still seem like yourself, Perrin said, though Rand caught a slight hesitation on the word seem. Had Perrin been about to say smell instead? You haven't changed that much. Rand doubted he could explain it to Perrin without sounding mad. The person he became when he wore the mantle of the dragon reborn. That wasn't simply an act. Wasn't simply a mask. It was who he was. He had not changed. He had not transformed. He had merely accepted. That didn't mean he had all of the answers. Despite 400 years of memories nestled in his brain, he still worried about what he had to do. Luce Theron hadn't known how to seal the boar. His attempt had led to disaster. The taint, the breaking, all for an imperfect prison with seals that were now brittle. One answer kept coming to Rand, a dangerous answer, one that Luce Theron hadn't considered. What if the answer wasn't to seal the Dark One away again? What if the answer, the final answer, was something else, something more permanent? Yes, Rand thought to himself for the 100th time. But is it possible? They arrived at the tent where the clerks worked, the maidens fanning out behind them, Rand and Perrin entering. The clerks were up late, of course, and they didn't look surprised to see Rand enter.
My lord dragon,
Bulwer said, bowing stiffly from where he stood beside a table of maps and stacks of paper. The dried-up little man sorted his papers nervously, one knobby elbow protruding from a hole in his oversized brown coat. Report, Rand said.
Roadrun will come,
Bulwer said, his voice thin and precise.
The Queen of Andor has sent for him, promising him gateways made by those kinswomen of hers. Our eyes in his court say he is angry that he needs her help to attend, but is insistent that he needs to be at this meeting, if only so he doesn't look left out.
Excellent, Rand said. Elaine knows nothing of your spies?
My lord,
Bulwer said, sounding indignant. Have you determined who is spying for her among our clerks? Rand asked. Bulwer sputtered.
Nobody.
She'll have someone, Bulwer, Rand said with a smile. She'll but taught me how to do this, after all. No matter. After tomorrow, my intentions will be manifest for all. Secrets won't be needed. None save the ones I keep closest to my own heart.
That means everyone will be here for the meeting, right?
Perrin asked.
Every major ruler? Tyr and Ilion?
The Ammerlin persuaded them to come, Bulwer said. I have copies of their exchanges here if you wish to see them, my lords.
I would, Rand said. Send them to my tent. I will look them over tonight. The shaking of the ground came suddenly. Clerks grabbed stacks of papers, holding them down and crying out as furniture crashed to the ground around them. Outside, men shouted, barely audible over the sound of trees breaking, metal clanging. The land groaned, a distant rumble. Rand felt it like a painful muscle spasm. Thunder shook the sky, distant, like a promise of things to come. The shaking subsided. The clerks remained holding their stacks of paper, as if afraid to let go and risk them toppling. It's really here, Rand thought. I'm not ready, we're not ready, but it's here anyway. He had spent many months fearing this day. Ever since Trollocs had come in the night, ever since Lan and Moiraine had dragged him from the Two Rivers, he had feared what was to come. The last battle. The end. He found himself unafraid now that it had come. Worried, but not afraid. I'm coming for you, Rand thought. Tell the people, Rand said to his clerks. Post warnings. Earthquakes will continue. Storms, real ones, terrible ones. There will be a breaking, and we cannot avoid it. The Dark One will try to grind this world to dust. The clerks nodded, shooting concerned glances at one another by lamplight.
Perrin looked contemplative, but nodded faintly, as if to himself. "Any other news?" Rand asked.
"The Queen of Andor may be up to something tonight, my lord," Bulwer said.
"Something is not a very descriptive word, Bulwer," Rand said. Bulwer grimaced.
"I'm sorry, my lord. I don't have more for you yet. I only just received this note. Queen Elaine was awakened by some of her advisers a short time ago. I don't have anyone close enough to know why."
Rand frowned, resting his hand on Layman's sword at his waist.
"It could just be plans for tomorrow," Perrin said.
"True," Rand said. "Let me know if you discover anything, Bulwer. Thank you. You do well here." The man stood taller. In these last days, days so dark, every man looked for something useful to do. Bulwer was the best at what he did, and was confident in his own abilities. Still, it did no harm to be reminded of the fact by one who employed him, particularly if his employer was none other than the Dragon Reborn. Rand left the tent, Perrin following.
"You're worried about it," Perrin said. "Whatever it was that awoke Elaine." "They would not awaken her without good cause," Rand said softly. "Considering her state."
Pregnant.
Pregnant with his children. Light. He'd only just learned of it. Why hadn't she been the one to tell him?
The answer was simple. Elaine could feel Rand's emotions as he felt hers. She would have been able to feel how he had been recently. Before Dragonmount. Back when... Well, she wouldn't have wanted to confront him with a pregnancy when he'd been in such a state. Beyond that, he hadn't exactly made himself easy to find. Still, it was a shock.
"I'm going to be a father," he thought, not for the first time. Yes, Luz Theron had had children, and Rand could remember them and his love for them. It wasn't the same. He, Randall Thor, would be a father, assuming he won the last battle.
"They wouldn't have awakened Elaine without good reason," he continued, returning to task.
"I'm worried, not because of what might have happened, but because of the potential distraction. Tomorrow will be an important day. If the Shadow has any inkling of tomorrow's importance, it will try whatever it can to keep us from meeting, from unifying."
Perrin scratched at his beard.
"I have people close to Elaine, people who keep watch on things for me."
Rand raised his hand.
"Let's go talk to them. I have a great deal to do tonight, but... Yes, I can't let this slip."
The two turned toward Perrin's camp nearby, picking up their pace, Rand's bodyguards following like shadows with bales and spears.
The night felt too quiet. Egwene, in her tent, worked on a letter to Rand. She was not certain if she would send it. Sending it was not important. Writing it was about organizing her thoughts, determining what she wished to say to him. Gawain pushed his way into the tent again, hand on his sword, warder cloak rustling. "Are you going to stay in this time?" Egwene asked, dipping her pen. "Or are you going to go right back out?"
"I don't like this night, Egwene."
He looked over his shoulder.
"Something feels wrong about it."
"The world holds its breath, Gawain, waiting upon the events of the morrow. Did you send to Elaine as I requested?"
"Yes. She won't be awake. It's too late for her."
"We shall see." It wasn't long before a messenger arrived from Elaine's camp, bearing a small folded letter. Egwene read it, then smiled. "Come," she said to Gawain, rising and gathering a few things. She waved a hand, and a gateway split the air.
"We're traveling there?" Gawain asked. "It's only a short walk."
"A short walk would require the Amyrlin to call upon the Queen of Andor," Egwene said, as Gawain stepped through the gateway first and checked the other side. Sometimes I don't want to take an action that starts people asking questions. Suan would have killed for this ability, Egwene thought as she stepped through the gateway. How many more plots could that woman have spun if she'd been able to visit others as quickly, quietly, and easily as this? On the other side, Elaine stood beside a warm brazier. The queen wore a pale green dress, her belly swollen from the babes within. She hastened over to Egwene and kissed her ring. Birgitta stood to one side of the tent flaps, arms folded, wearing her short red jacket and wide sky-blue trousers, her golden braid down over her shoulder. Gawain cocked an eyebrow at his sister.
"I'm surprised you are awake."
"I'm waiting for a report," Elaine said, gesturing for Egwene to join her in a pair of cushioned chairs beside the brazier. "Something important?" Egwene asked. Elaine frowned. "Jessamine forgot to check in again from Camelin. I left the woman strict orders to send to me every 2 hours, and yet she dallies. Light. It's probably nothing. Still, I asked Serenia to go to the traveling grounds to check on things for me. I hope you don't mind."
"You need rest," Gawain said, folding his arms.
"Thank you very much for the advice," Elaine said, "which I will ignore as I ignored Birgitta when she said the same thing. Mother, what is it you wished to discuss?" Egwene handed over the letter she had been working on. "To Rand?" Elaine asked. "You have a different perspective on him than I. Tell me what you think of this letter. I might not send it to him. I haven't decided yet." "The tone is forceful," Elaine noted. "He doesn't seem to respond to anything else." After a moment of reading, Elaine lowered the letter. "Perhaps we should simply let him do as he wishes." "Break the seals?" Egwene asked. "Release the Dark One?" "Why not?" "Light, Elaine?"
"It has to happen, doesn't it?" Elaine asked. "I mean, the Dark One's going to escape. He's practically free already."
Egwene rubbed her temples. "There is a difference between touching the world and being free. During the War of Power, the Dark One was never truly released into the world. The Boar let him touch it, but that was resealed before he could escape. If the Dark One had entered the world, the wheel itself would have been broken. Here, I brought this to show you." Egwene retrieved a stack of notes from her satchel. The sheets had been hastily gathered by the librarians of the 13th Depository. "I'm not saying that we shouldn't break the seals," Egwene said. "I'm saying that we can't afford to risk one of Rand's crack-brained schemes with this." Elaine smiled fondly. Light, but she was smitten. "I can rely on her, can't I?" It was hard to tell with Elaine these days. The woman's ploy with the kinswomen. "We have unfortunately found nothing pertinent in your library, Tarangreal." The statue of the smiling bearded man had nearly caused a riot in the tower. Every sister had wanted to read the thousands of books that it held. All of the books seemed to have been written before the Boar was opened. "They will keep searching, but these notes contain everything we could gather on the seals, the prison, and the Dark One. If we break the seals at the wrong time, I fear it would mean an end to all things. Here, read this." She handed a page to Elaine.
"The Kuriathon cycle?" Elaine asked, curious. "And light shall fail, and dawn shall not come, and still the captive rails. The captive is the Dark One?"
"I think so," Egwene said. "The prophecies are never clear. Rand intends to enter the last battle and break the seals immediately, but that is a dreadful idea. We have an extended war ahead of us. Freeing the Dark One now will strengthen the forces of the Shadow and weaken us. If it is to be done, and I still don't know that it has to be, We should wait until the last possible moment. At the very least, we need to discuss it. Rand has been right about many things, but he has been wrong, too. This is not a decision he should be allowed to make alone. Elaine shuffled through the sheets of paper, then stopped on one of them. His blood shall give us the light. She rubbed the page with her thumb as if lost in thought. Wait upon the light. Who added this note? That is Daniela Alievin's copy of the Termandal translation of the Koreathon cycle, Egwene said. Daniela made her own notes, and they have been the subject of nearly as much discussion among scholars as the prophecies themselves. She was a dreamer, you know. The only Amerlin that we know of to have been one. Before me, anyway.
Yes, Elaine said.
The sisters who gathered these for me came to the same conclusion that I have, Egwene said. There may be a time to break the seals, but that time is not at the start of the last battle, whatever Rand thinks. We must wait for the right moment, and as the watcher of the seals, it is my duty to choose that moment. I won't risk the world on one of Rand's overly dramatic stratagems.
He has a fair bit of gleemin' in him, Elaine said, again fondly. Your argument is a good one, Egwene. Make it to him. He will listen to you. He does have a good mind, and can be persuaded.
We shall see. For now, I...
Egwene suddenly sensed a spike of alarm from Gawain. She glanced over to see him turning. Hoofbeats outside. His ears weren't any better than Egwene's, but it was his job to listen for things like this. Egwene embraced the true source, causing Elaine to do likewise.
Birgitta already had the tent flaps open, hand on her sword. A frazzled messenger leaped from horseback outside, eyes wide. She scrambled into the tent, Birgitta and Gawain falling in beside her immediately, watching in case she came too close. She didn't.
"Camlin is under attack, Your Majesty," the woman said, gasping for breath.
"What?" Elaine leaped to her feet.
"How? Did Jared Sarand finally—"
"Trollocs," the messenger said.
"It started near dusk."
"Impossible," Elaine said, grabbing the messenger by the arm and hauling her out of the tent. Egwene followed hastily.
"It's been over 6 hours since dusk," Elaine said to the messenger. "Why haven't we heard anything until now? What happened to the kinswomen?"
"I was not told, my queen," the messenger said. "Captain Gaibon sent me to fetch you at speed. He just arrived through the gateway." The traveling ground was not far from Elaine's tent. A crowd had gathered, but men and women made way for the Amerlin and the queen. In moments, the two of them reached the front. A group of men in bloodied clothing trudged through the open gateway, pulling carts laden with Elaine's new weapons, the dragons. Many of the men seemed near collapse. They smelled of smoke, and their skin was blackened by soot. Not a few of them slumped unconscious as Elaine's soldiers grabbed the carts, which were obviously meant for horses to pull, to help them. Other gateways opened nearby, as Serenia Sedai and some of the stronger of the kinswomen, Egwene wouldn't think of them as Elaine's kinswomen, created them. Refugees poured through like the waters of a suddenly unstopped river.
"Go," Egwene said to Gawain, weaving her own gateway, one to the traveling grounds and the White Tower camp nearby.
"Send for as many Aes Sedai as we can rouse. Tell Bryn to ready his soldiers. Tell them to do as Elaine orders and send them through gateways to the outskirts of Camlann. We will show solidarity with Andor."
Gawain nodded, ducking through the gateway. Egwene let it vanish, then joined Elaine near the gathering of wounded, confused soldiers.
Sumiko, of the kinswomen, had taken charge of seeing that healing was given to those in immediate danger. The air was thick with the smell of smoke. As Egwene hurried to Elaine, she caught sight of something through one of the gateways.
Camlann afire.
Light! She stood stunned for a moment, then hurried on.
Elaine was speaking with Gaibon, commander of the Queen's Guard. The handsome man seemed barely able to remain on his feet, his clothing and arms alarmingly bloodied.
"Dark friends killed two of the women you left to send messages, Your Majesty," he was saying in a tired voice. "Another fell in the fighting, but we retrieved the dragons. Once we escaped."
He seemed pained by something.
"Once we escaped through the hole in the city wall, we found that several mercenary bands were making their way around the city toward the gate that Lord Talmanis had left defended. By coincidence, they were near enough to aid in our escape."
"You did well," Elaine said.
"But the city..."
"You did well," Elaine repeated, voice firm. "You retrieved the dragons and rescued all of these people? I will see you rewarded for this, Captain."
"Give your reward to the men of the band, Your Majesty. It was their work. And please, if you can do anything for Lord Talmanis..."
He gestured to the fallen man whom several members of the band had just carried through the gateway. Elaine knelt beside him, and Egwene joined her. At first, Egwene assumed that Talmanis was dead, with his skin blackened. Then he drew a ragged breath.
"Light," Elaine said, delving his prostrate form. "I've never seen anything like this."
"Thakandar blades," Gaibon said.
"This is beyond either of us," Egwene said to Elaine, standing. She trailed off, hearing something over the groans of soldiers and carts creaking.
"Egwene?" Elaine asked softly.
"Do what you can for him," Egwene said, standing and rushing away. She pushed through the confused crowd, following the voice. "Was that?"
"Yes."
"There." She found an open